This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 24th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 268 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on the show, we meet journalist and author David Eimer, who's travelled through China's hinterlands. He'll tell us of this other side of China, where Beijing's dominance is questioned and challenged by numerous ethnic minorities.
Then we continue with the demise of American furniture manufacturing and hear of how one local entrepreneur successfully fought offshoring and helped save an American town.
And later in the programme, we'll look at the history of Europe's largest street festival, the Notting Hill Carnival, and hear of those who created the event but never got the credit for it.
All that and, of course, some great music too, coming up right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards and Andrew Tuck. Another Sunday lunchtime programme of chat, Andrew. It's good to be here.
Are you looking at my finger?
A little bit. I think you should tell our listeners. They can't see. We don't have studio cam, but you've got quite a bound digit.
I've got a mummified finger. This is because I was leaving my house and I shut the door very fast and hard, and I forgot that my finger was still in door, and I completely flattened my finger. I thought I was going to faint. I did lie on the floor for about an hour. I said many words that I've forgotten I knew.
Many angry words.
Many angry words came out.
How's it bring up? You haven't broken it? What about your nail?
That's why I've got the glove puppet on, because I think the nail will drop off. And when I look at people, they're kind of... Interestingly, though, and you're one of these people, once you start telling people about your finger being shut in a door, there are many finger stories. Isabel Kaiser, who works for us, she told us the story of 3 years ago, she was making some fruit juice, and she put her finger in the mixer, and it took the top of her finger off.
Yeah.
Just attached by one last bit of bone. And she had to go to the... I don't know, how would you go to the hospital? She didn't even have the carrot juice to kind of get her going. She had to leave the... anyway, the finger wasn't in the carrot juice. She went to the hospital.
And it's now restored.
And it's now restored. There's a bit of a kind of a kink in the road, as you might say.
Yeah. Ein bisschen nach links. Yeah. As they would say.
And then I heard about a poor child and an ice cream.
Oh, yeah, this is me. Well, you know... My grandmother was a fearsome lady, and I was very worried that I didn't want to drip my ice cream in her car. It was a copper-coloured Ford Escort, as I recall. And so as my ice cream dripped, I reached out the side, because we were parked, I reached out the side so that it would drip out onto the side of the road. And Granny was running around the car, getting the doors ready to move off. Slammed the door, all three fingers in the door.
Oh!
Yeah.
Oh! And only a child.
A little wee child, yeah.
I'd give you
that. I still didn't drop my ice cream.
Poor Marcus Hippie, the producer. I can see he wants to come in and give you a hug.
There'll be time for that later, Marcus, now. Come on. So that's been this week. It's been a week of digital trauma. What about next week? The book launch, Andrew.
I'm going to stub my toe. No, next week, I've talked about this for a long time. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is actually in the office, both the special edition. You have to have more money for that one, and the regular one. But we start going on tour with it next week. So we're doing an event here at the offices for all of our readers and subscribers who are going to come to a party here for a book signing with Tyler and yours truly. And then we're going to be at Selfridges on Thursday, another book signing. And then the following week, the book tour starts. So we start in Berlin, and then we go to Paris. We're also going to be coming live from Maison et Objet. And then we're going to be the following day in Antwerp. So... Back on the book bus.
Back on tour. We'll be chalking off a few of those destinations. One man, Andrew, who'll be on some of the legs of that tour, will be one of our colleagues. I don't know where he stands on digital trauma, but he's a young American.
With slightly short legs.
It's Daniel Giacopelli. It is time indeed to look ahead to the next week's news today, and we are joined by Daniel Giacopelli. Daniel, welcome.
Great to be here, Tom, as always.
I know you love spending your Sunday lunchtimes with us, don't you?
I do indeed.
Well, perhaps you could tell us, what's first on your list of things we need to know?
Well, as you know, tomorrow it's the Burning Man Festival.
Oh, yeah.
And this is a very elite music and cultural arts festival. So I know, Tom, you've bought your tickets quite early for this.
Well, I'm fascinated by this because there's lots of sort of peripheral things that go on around this, aren't there? Social elements, financial, economic constraints on people who go and participate. It's quite an interesting model, isn't it?
And people take their clothes off.
Yeah. Well, exactly. It's a very...
There's always fringe benefits to these
It's
things.
A psychedelic festival. I've never been. I do have a couple friends from college who are going this year. Now that we're of an age where we could afford to do such things, Tom. But yeah, I mean, I would love to go. It seems pretty crazy. Well, it starts tomorrow. It goes on for a couple of days.
Just as far as I understand it, you know, this started off as pretty fringe.
Exactly.
But like all of these things, it begins to attract some money and has got some kind of bigger events and now attached to it. Does it still kind of, do you think, maintain its kind of... It's kind of otherness. It is a bit kind of crazier than some of the other events. After some of the events you've listed on this show, I'm not sure that I can say that.
Where do you see what's coming up after this? No, I mean, it does seem like it has become a kind of larger than life. Nobody really knows what happens at it unless you go there. But it seems pretty awesome. I mean, I would love to go. There's lots of illicit things that go on there, though. So
we'll pay for you to go, but you have to keep your pants on.
I'll do a report.
Okay.
Well,
pretty awesome. I love that, Danny. That's nice.
I mean... After that now, you must know we're going to go to Wales for the World Bog Snorkeling Championships.
Now, you need to explain exactly what this is. This is a bog in the sense of peat, isn't it?
Exactly. It's the peat bog outside an incomprehensibly named town in Wales. Lots of consonants. They complete two lengths of a water-filled 60-yard trench in the quickest time possible, but without using conventional swimming strokes. It's a race of approximately 20 miles.
Wow. That's muddy and boggy.
Oh, actually, no. The 20 miles one is held the same day, but this one's not that long. It's two lengths of a 60-yard trench.
Oh, 120. That's pretty different.
Sorry, yeah. The mountain bike bog leaping point is 20 miles. Held the same day, though.
That's how long it is far to drive to the restaurant afterwards, isn't it?
Exactly.
Okay, so that wasn't very well timed. But anyway, we'll have to see if we can do better with the next one.
Also happening tomorrow, it's Mr. Gay World 2014 in Rome. 32 delegates from around the world for the titles of Worldwide Mr. Gay and Gay World Ambassador. It's billed as the 21st Century Beauty Contest.
Only 32. That's not many.
It doesn't seem like that many.
I know. Are they representatives of particular nations? Is that how it works?
Or? Yeah, last year's winner was Mr. New Zealand. Oh. There you go. That's in Rome. Also, quite serious this week. Scotland is probably going to become an independent.
That was quite
nation.
Seriously. Well, yeah. Whoever wins, you know, especially if they're from New Zealand, that would be big news.
New Zealand won last year, but okay. Scotland's going to vote. Voters will receive postal votes. Those who requested to have a postal vote will get them for their independence referendum this week.
They've still got a bit more time, haven't they, to consider their options.
Sure, but the ballots will start going out next week.
Oh, yes, but they still want the Royal Mail to deliver it.
This is the old question. Obviously, everyone's talking about
yes
finance.
Or no.
Everyone's talking about things like service provision, like post energy, which is, of course, also, from what I gather, there's quite a lot of crossover, cross-border energy usage.
And cross-language as well, because there's been dispute this week about how much oil, actually, they have left in Scotland. The Scottish Parliament says quite a lot, and some kind of analysts said, actually, not so much.
What would happen over in the US of states, Danny?
It's a huge issue over in Long Island.
No, but I'm saying if people sent if there was an actual referendum, I know there's some bulk
actually happens all the time. It happens all the time. We have tons of these movements in the US,
but they don't really have much traction, do they?
You don't actually get to vote.
No, they never actually get to be too serious. There's one proposition right now in California. Tim Draper, a famous venture capitalist in Silicon Valley, his proposal is to divide California into, I think, five or six different states. He's kind of a very important character. I mean, but people are saying this will actually never, ever happen, because the problem with these movements in the U.S. is that as soon as you do that, you'll get extra representation for the same geographic area. So no other state would back that. I mean, essentially, they could triple their influence in Washington, D.C. overnight.
I guess the one vote that is possible, which we have a film about on Monocle.com, is Puerto Rico, which isn't quite a state, but doesn't know whether it wants to fully be a state and become part of America, or actually kind of go its own way. Well, some people don't.
Yeah, Puerto Rico's a really odd case where I don't really know why it hasn't been made a state yet. It just kind of, they don't have certain rights that other American citizens have, and it's kind of in this weird limbo where lots of people do want to become a state, lots of people are like, well, hold on, not yet. Well,
thanks for shining light on that as well, Danny. That was good. Clarity is coming through today on the Monocle Weekly.
Well, up next, on the 27th, it's the annual tomato throwing festival in Spain.
Oh, that is
La Tomatina.
La Tomatina, that is an absolute rip snorter.
Yeah.
No, I'm too fastidious about, you know.
Oh, don't get that on my white
clothing.
T-shirt.
Exactly, I couldn't handle it.
I once had a flatmate who broke his all of his teeth. Because he slipped.
With a tomato.
In fact, we were interviewing for a new flatmate at my house, and this guy comes without, he's missing his two front teeth, and he told us this story about how he bought a Volvo for £5,000 with his friends, drove to Spain, and then he slipped on tomatoes and he broke all of his teeth.
But at the festival, or actually
at
in
the festival.
I thought he'd just gone to like the local supermarket and someone had kind of left a cherry tomato on the floor. Oops!
Embellished the story afterwards.
So that's that.
Wow.
Well, Danny.
Good week coming up, guys.
We have a surprise for you.
Yeah? Is it tomato?
Yeah, you get outside. We're going to start running. Get your sneakers on.
Okay, I'm leaving.
Thank you very much, Danny. That's Danny Jacopelli looking ahead to the next week. Mm-hmm. And you'll be able to hear more about some of those stories, possibly, unlikely, here on Monocle 24. The Weekly, though, continues next with an author and journalist who's explored the outer reaches of China. Stay tuned to find out more here on The Weekly. Even though the Communist Party in Beijing have the power in China, there are many corners of the country where the reality is very different. It's a very different China from the way the nation is perceived by the Western world. But it's where our guest, journalist David Eimer, has been travelling.
And he's now written a new book, The Emperor Far Away, Travels at the Edge of China. And he joins us in the studio to tell us more. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. David, when we look at modern China, it's a nation that seems to be seamless, but those seams are beginning to kind of pop open in places. We see every day in the newspapers what's happening with the Uyghur people. We've seen reports of Buddhist monks burning themselves to death in Tibet. How much are those fractures occurring around the country, and are they likely to pull the country apart, do you think?
Well, they're definitely on the increase and accelerating. Whether you can say it's going to pull the country apart is a different issue. And I certainly believe that the biggest threat to the Communist Party's rule isn't going to be another sort of pro-democracy uprising like Tiananmen in 1989. It is going to come from its far edges. It's going to come from the Uyghurs or the Tibetans. And, I think in Xinjiang and the far west, they're facing a minor sort of insurgency, a very minor one at the moment, but it could increase.
But when you look at what happened with, you know, the Soviet Union, we think of the Soviet Union and, you know, the 60s or 70s or 80s even, it seemed to be a permanent force. You know, it seemed unlikely that it would crack apart. And suddenly that whole kind of empire disentangled within a matter of years. We see some attempts to try and put it back together again now. But when you look at China, do you think that those, if you get the right fissure running through one of these situations, you know, here in with the which you cover in great depth, that with the Uyghur people, this is a division between the Han Chinese and the Uyghur. This is a division along religious lines as well. Do you think that one of those fissures is enough to start a domino effect, like we did see with the Soviet Union?
Yeah, it's tempting to compare the demise of the Soviet Union, you know, with what's happening in China now. I think, you know, with China, it's certainly their biggest fear. They look to the Soviet Union and see an empire just gone in a matter of months and its former leaders reviled or forgotten, and it scares them. I frankly think the Chinese are more ruthless than the Soviets were. I think they will do anything to make sure that their empire stays together. And you're seeing that now in places like Xinjiang with the Uyghurs and Tibet in terms of the sort of crackdown on what's going on there. On religious freedom, freedom of expression, which is obviously, you know, they crack down on everywhere. Whether all-out war in Xinjiang would cause a collapse of the Communist Party, I wouldn't offer an opinion on that. I think it would. I don't think it would.
But they look nervously at the past, anyway.
Definitely. I mean, I think they're very, very concerned. I mean, I think this is their sort of internal security is their number one, along with maintaining, you know, economic performance is definitely their number one priority.
And David, it intrigues me then when you sort of came to write the book and you went to these, you know, maybe sort of somewhat forgotten corners of the country. And there, maybe that's an attitude in Beijing to try and, you know, brush these things under the carpet somewhat. But also for, you know, Western writers who go to China, there's a lot of travel writing. It's still a lot of it has a lot of almost sort of romantic quality. And there seems to be a bit of a reticence almost to really delve into some of these really pressing issues that maybe are the fraying edges, if you will. Were you very sort of aware of that and very keen to really ask those tough questions? Was that why you sought to kind of go to those hinterlands, if you like?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I say in the book, the motivation for doing the book was to, you know, try and give these people at the edges a voice. Because, you know, we don't have one in China, and you know, in the outside world knows almost next to nothing about them. I mean, even in Beijing, I mean, you know, most Han Chinese people will have no idea. They may have been to Tibet, which is quite a popular destination, but, you know, many of the minorities, I've never met anyone from that minority. They're completely absent from TV, they're not on the movies, you know, they're not mentioned in popular discourse. They're obviously excluded from politics. So they really are, you know, they are an invisible people. I mean, it's really just the Uyghurs and Tibetans that the West knows about just because, you know, they're rebelling.
And tell us, you know, you've traveled around the country, you've been to the Mekong, you've been all the way, as we said, to, you know, Kashgar and the territories of the Uyghurs over in the West. When you travel around the country, how strong still are these different communities? Because we see, in the, again, from many reports, that the Han Chinese, one of their attempts, or Beijing's attempts to kind of quell dissent, is by making everywhere kind of the same, by shipping in Han people to implant those communities. How strong do you feel that, you know, when you rock up in Kashgar, is it still very different from the rest of China?
It's not as different as it was. When I first went there in 88, it was overwhelmingly a Uyghur city. Now, the level of Han migration has just gone through the roof in the last 20 years, not just there, but in Tibet. And that has just only fueled the anger of the indigenous people there, because they're seeing what they regard as their homeland being taken over. I still think there are many bits of China where, on the edges, where you can go where you don't feel like you're in China. I mean, you can go to the sort of southwestern frontiers and you could be in Burma, you could be in Laos, you could be in Thailand, just from the languages people talk, from the food they eat, from the weather. You go to the far northeast, you could be in Siberia, you could be in North Korea. So there are plenty of places where, I mean, it's such a huge country. That
maybe just give us a little bit of the, you know, for our listeners, a bit of the colour of what it was like travelling to these very remote places. You know, I know in the magazine we had a writer in Kashgar not long ago. That certainly wasn't very easy to find a hotel that was safe to put them up in, or that were reliable, you know, getting people there. Then the police wanted to, you know, kind of check who you were the minute you arrived. Tell us a little bit of the colour of travelling around China.
I think it's increasingly difficult. I mean, the Chinese now are basically shutting down Xinjiang, just as they have Tibet. So your writer was lucky to go when he did. I did it by subterfuge. In some cases, you know, I've got two passports, I switched them around, I pretended to be a normal tourist as opposed to my passport, which has a journalist visa in. If I hadn't done that, I wouldn't have got into Tibet. Sometimes I crossed land borders illegally, like, you know, from southwestern China into Golden Triangle, into Burma, just go across the river. It's, you know, they're always wary of foreigners going to areas which they regard as sensitive. You know, you check into a hotel, everyone's going to know there's a foreigner in town because you're probably the only foreigner in town, and you stick out a mile. And, one of the concerns with the book is not so much for me. I never felt, the only time I feel in personal danger in China is when I'm on a bus, generally, just because of the way they drive. But, I mean, I was very concerned about the people I spoke to. They're obviously all under false names in the book. But, you know, meeting them even, you know, I was very careful about where I met them. Try and make it seem, you know, it's like a, you know, I'm not a journalist sitting down to do an interview. Try and look after the locals more, because they're the ones who will get into real trouble rather than me.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Is there a sense that it's sort of, you know, Beijing is on your trail? When you go to these more far-flung reaches that are almost sort of semi-autonomous, you talk about this region close to the border with Burma where they're almost like pseudo-independent states. Who is it who's looking out? Is it sort of local party apparatchiks? Is it sort of central government? What's the feeling there? It's such a straight, because it's so far away from Beijing. You mentioned that distance, literally and metaphorically. I wonder who it is who's kind of keeping an eye on things.
Well, the parties, the Chinese are a nation which runs on hierarchies. And so even go, you know, you might be dealing with a local official. He's answering to someone, and the chain's running all the way back to Beijing. And if it's urgent enough, they will get on the phone. You can't generalize about local officials. I've had, local officials have been very pleasant and others who've been very unpleasant. And I think any journalist, who's worked in China would tell you the same. Sometimes they'll sort of literally drag you away and kick you out. Sometimes they'll sort of drag you to a restaurant and give you an enormous meal while telling you, oh, there's nothing going on here. You might as well go home. It depends. Yeah, they do it in different ways. But, I mean, it's a bit like, when the British ran the empire, the idea of a public school system was that, you could send some 24-year-old out of public school and he would think exactly like the British government. And it's kind of like that. So their officials, they know what Beijing will want and what they won't want. And so they interpret, there's a looseness, but they follow the party line.
And tell me, the aggression which you say with which, Beijing is going to attempt to control the situation, just returning to the issue with the Uyghurs, just because it has been in the press so much. When you spoke to people there, what was your feeling about what they wanted? There's obviously, we see groups in the West who are Uyghur campaigning for this. There is some pressure from people who believe there should be independence. But is that what people are after, or are they asked after some cultural protection when you travelled around the fringes, or are they looking for a more federated China? What was your feeling about what angered people about what was happening?
I think with the case of the Uyghurs, they would want an independent state. Their history is slightly different from Tibet in the sense that Tibet's always had some links with China, even if they were very tenuous ones. So, for example, the Dalai Lama says, we don't want independence, we want a sort of more autonomy. Basically, you can run our foreign affairs, but we want to run the country ourselves. I think now the situation has got to the point that it's too late, really, for Beijing to make sort of concessions, which they would accept. I mean, Beijing sort of says, we treat the minorities well, we let you have more kids, you're not subject to the one-child policy. They have to score fewer points on a university entrance exam. But that doesn't obviously, cancel out taking their country, taking their resources and effectively colonizing it. I think they just feel marginalized and excluded by the level of Han migration and the way that has excluded them from economic life especially. They're at the bottom of the pile economically. They really are at a very desperate state, and that's why you're seeing the flare-up in violence. I mean, the violence in Xinjiang, they're almost like the monks in Tibet setting fire to themselves. They're suicide attacks, really. If you run into a Chinese train station and stab 30 people, you're not going to get away with it. And you know that it's China and you're going to be executed within the week. So they've reached that level. It's that level of desperation. But same as a monk saying, the only way I can make a protest is covering myself in petrol and setting myself on fire.
It's an extraordinary story of an extraordinary country, and it's told most eloquently in the pages of The Emperor Far Away. David Eimer, thanks very much for coming on to The Weekly to tell us all about it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Andrew, I feel like the need for some a little musical light relief now. How do you feel about that?
Let's do this.
Okay, but should we keep a loose kind of Chinese association going?
And if anyone's offended, let's blame Marcus Hippie.
Indeed, let's do that. So this, to continue that Chinese theme, is Coldplay and Rihanna. Together, it's Princess of China. Once upon a time, somebody ran away, saying as fast as I can, I got to go, I got to go. Once upon a time, we fell apart, you're holding in your hands the two halves of my heart.
Well, that was Coldplay featuring Rihanna with Princess of China. After the break, we'll hear about one American entrepreneur who successfully fought against offshoring of the furniture manufacturing industry and managed to stay local. Stay tuned.
Monocle has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle shop.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards. We continue with journalist and author Beth Macy, who's just published a book on the demise of the furniture-making industry in Virginia and North Carolina.
It's been a pretty sad story. Scores of furniture-making plants have closed during the last two decades, mostly because of competition from other countries, China in particular. The name of the book is Factory Man: How One Furniture Maker Battled Offshoring, Stayed Local, and Helped Save an American Town. And author Beth Macy joins us now. Beth, great to speak with you. Thanks for joining us on The Weekly. The book, I guess, zeroes in particular on this one character, John Bassett III, handsomely named fellow, one particular sort of entrepreneur who was very determined to fight against the sorts of changes, this offshoring trend. I guess the first question for you is how successful has his campaign been?
Yes, well, he filed in 2003 what was at the time the world's largest anti-dumping petition against China, and he won at the U.S. International Trade Commission, and he won twice, once in 2005 and again in 2010. In a unanimous vote, they proved that the Chinese factories, that many of them were illegally dumping product in an effort to put the American manufacturers out of business. And he won the case, resulting in, you know, millions being pumped back to some of the fellow petitioners in the case.
Now, you should explain to us a little bit about how you met this incredibly colorful character, John Bassett III, and how you got to know his story.
Right. Well, I am a reporter for the Roanoke Times in Southwest Virginia, and about an hour south of here is a community called Martinsville in Henry County, which is where Bassett, Virginia is. And that's the town where he was reared, and very much an unincorporated company town that was created solely for the manufacture of furniture. And in 1982, he was kind of elbowed out of the business he was born to inherit by his older, shrewder, perhaps, brother-in-law, and he reemerged at a company in Galax called Vaughn Bassett. It's confusing because of all the similar names. But I had originally set out to tell the story of the aftermath of globalization on Bassett in Henry County because it had had the largest, highest unemployment rate in the state for over a decade. And what happened to the workforce there? Half of the workforce in Henry County had lost their jobs, and how are they doing now? That was my original question when I sent out to write this series for my newspaper in 2012. And along the way, I heard, well, there was this other guy who had managed to buck the trend, and not only had he taken on China in this Court of International Trade and won and kept his factory in Galax, Virginia going, which was 70 miles away the other direction, but he was this great character, and writing about him would allow me to tell kind of the social history of this industry, what had happened, and just how hard it is to make it today in this new globalized world.
And Beth, I'm interested. I mean, these are certainly areas that we talk about a lot at Monocle and on Monocle 24 about thinking globally but acting locally, about making. Do you feel that the book actually serves not just then as a sort of social history, as you've described, but as something of a primer of how to tackle the menace, if you like, of offshoring, about how to keep acting local, about how to, you know, ensure that these businesses, which are more than just a business, can survive?
I think so. I think there are some lessons embedded in it for sure. One of my big takeaways, and I say this right in chapter one, is that after hundreds of interviews, I sort of put together just myself, and I'm not a business reporter, but it seems to me as if in this country anyways, in the U.S., nobody is really minding the back room of the new global store. So it takes somebody, you know, with this chip on his shoulder and pretty big ego and a lot of money in the bank and basically an outlier in his industry because he's now the largest wood bedroom manufacturer because he's basically the only one left. It takes somebody like that who's willing to call foul and say, look, guys, China isn't playing by the rules. And that's exactly what he did when he filed that anti-dumping petition. And he also, I mean, you talked about the lessons in the book. I mean, he's constantly re-engineering the way his factory runs. You know, he's saying, well, if China can beat us on the lowest price, we can beat them on the length of time it takes to get the furniture into the store. So he re-engineered the way his furniture is delivered. You can get it super fast. He specialized in the mom and pop stores who couldn't themselves afford to import an entire container full of furniture. He motivated his employees. He stood on top of a conveyor belt and said, the Chinese are not super people. They can't suck the ocean dry. And he communicated to them, and he still communicates to them every day he's in that factory.
Now, Beth, just picking up on what Tom was saying there, you know, what's been really interesting is if you look at, you know, the shoe industry in the US, how few companies there are left making shoes. And, you know, the furniture was another one of these examples where, you know, actually the industry kind of died away. You've hinted there at some of the ways that he managed to kind of turn the situation around. But what seems to be the problem for all of these countries is, you know, including the US, is actually is the consumer as well. If the consumer turns over the product and thinks, actually, it's made in China, but I don't care because it's cheap, there's a kind of education that has to go on there as well, isn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, I was writing my book proposal and I'm sitting in this beautiful recliner in my living room that I bought at the neighbor discount from my neighbor who owns a furniture store, and it's made in China. And I remembered when he showed it to me, he's rocking it back and forth in his store saying, you know, a swarm of high school wrestlers could pin each other on this chair and it wouldn't fall apart despite what we've heard about ersatz made in China furniture. And he's right, I love the chair. But I also realized, oh, wow, I'm part of this too. And I really think there's a lot of education that needs to happen. I myself got educated while I was working on this book. You just have to do your research before you spend your dollars. And now that I know these people in this factory and, you know, entire families worked in this factory where I've spent a lot of time lately, I see the impact that my dollar can make.
And Beth, it's interesting now, you mentioned research, and there's lots of detail, of course, in the book as well. And it's interesting, I always wonder in these stories that talk about influential business people, whether it's hyperlocal or internationally, you tend to need big characters to make these kind of changes and to make a difference. And with this particular, you know, John Bassett III, you've certainly got that. And there's some great stories, you know, there's Elvis Presley furniture. He tries to pitch to get the company out of bother. Is it true, do you think, that you do need a character first to both base a story like this around, but also to be successful when it comes to salvaging these kind of businesses?
You might be right. I mean, as a storyteller, and again, I'm not a business writer, I wanted to tell a story that I could give to my mom, who worked in a factory and was dislocated herself when everything about the factory changed. And it was the kind of book where I wanted to explain to myself and to somebody like my mom what had happened and why this country is the way it is now, and all these former mill towns, now sort of ghost towns. And I wanted to explain in a really clear language how it happened and was there another way. And of course, when I met him and just saw how brash and inspirational and larger than life he is, I knew I had stumbled upon storytelling gold. And I think it certainly doesn't hurt that he's as colorful as he is.
Now, apart from being a very well-written book, the New York Times has said it's going to be one of the books of the year and has said you won't be putting this book down. Why do you think there's such an appetite in the US for your writing? Because is this the story of, you know, the redeeming of American industry? What do you think people are finding between the covers beyond this amazing character and, of course, your fine writing that has so gripped them?
I think it's his fighting spirit, you know? I mean, he's 76 years old. He was a multimillionaire at birth in 1937. He doesn't have to do any of this. And you could say he does it because he has a huge ego or because, you know, he didn't cash out in the 90s when he could have and take his company public and that he's got a lot of his fortune tied up in it. But he's in that factory every day and he knows those people. And I think that resonates. It's like, oh, finally somebody in power cares about the little guy. And there's been so much uncaring about the little guy in this country. I mean, these factories closed. In my own newspaper, we reported every time a factory closed, we'd go down there and we'd write this very sad story. But nobody really thought to go back and sort of explain it all in a narrative way and to say, hey, how are these people doing now? I was going to end the book with chapter 27, which is when he's reopening a vacant plant next door, and this is a triumphant moment. But then I had to go on with an epilogue set in Bassett, Virginia, because that was what really kind of captured my heart after years of doing interviews there. This notion that these old abandoned plants would burn down. Some of them burnt because people were trying to salvage electrical casings to sell because that's how desperate they are there. And these factories would burn down and then the bulldozers would come and take them away. And people who'd worked in those plants and thought of their coworkers as family would come by and take a keepsake brick. And there was this moment at the end of the book where the guy burying the last of Bassett Superior Lines, which was once the most profitable furniture factory in the world, hands me a brick. And it just was such a loaded, beautiful moment. And I thought, this is it. This is the proof that the little guy didn't get to show everybody. This is what's happened to us. This is not what President Clinton said would happen in the late 90s when he said, you know, it'll be a win-win when China joins the WTO and we won't lose any jobs. Oh, yeah, this brick is proof of what really happened. And so that's how I had to end the story.
Absolutely. And Beth, I just wonder what, in terms of kind of consumer attitudes within the US then, apart from the overseas manufacturing, which obviously you've just been describing and the impact that's had, what about people's attitude towards products? I mean, Andrew mentioned shoes, and this is obviously a lot about furniture. Do you think there's more of a shift in that people just don't perceive furniture in the same way? It's not some sort of heritage artifact to be cherished and passed down. It's just this attitude that people have towards the disposability of things. Has that sort of also served to undermine certain parts of manufacturing?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I see stuff put out on my curb on my street all the time. Everything's kind of disposable. But I think it's the media's job to connect the dots between our purchases that we make and the livelihoods of our neighbors down the road in Martinsville and Henry County. Our dishwasher broke several months back and we were kind of broke at the time and we didn't replace it. We did our dishes. Well, that got old. And so then, you know, now that I've written this book, we were about to go out to Home Depot to buy a replacement dishwasher. And I thought, no, let's sit down and do our research first. And it turned out there was one made by Maytag in Kentucky. And it was happened to be on sale. It cost the same amount as the imported product. But if I hadn't sat down and done that 5 minutes worth of research before I went out to Home Depot, I might not have thought to ask. And I think that's starting to catch on here. Even Walmart has said they're going to purchase $250 billion worth of Made in America products over the next 10 years that they're going to have in their stores. But they're having a difficult time pulling it off, according to a recent story in the Wall Street Journal, because the supply chains have dried up. So it's going to take a while before we can get it back. And I think there are some other countries that we can look at who have done a better job of protecting their industry. And I'm hoping that that message gets carried forward. I mean, I would love that to be the legacy of this book.
Indeed, it would be a pretty powerful one. And let's hope that it works out. That's Beth Macy speaking to us from Virginia. Beth, thanks very much for joining us. And the book is How One Furniture Maker Battled Offshoring, Stayed Local and Helped Save an American Town, Factory Man. Beth, thanks for joining us here on The Weekly.
Thank you so much, Andrew and Tom.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wynn Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock.
If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
We finish this week's show with a look at what is now the largest street festival in Europe. It's once again time for the Notting Hill Carnival. And when in London, it's hard to avoid all the revellers heading to the festival. This year again, the carnival will see over 1 million visitors, aided by some 40,000 volunteers.
When Carnival launched, the area where it was held featured some of Britain's most deprived housing and was largely racially divided. This meant that making the festival happen, not to mention keeping it alive for the years to come, was not always easy. Our guests today, Ishmael Blagrove Jr. and Margaret Busby, wanted to give credit to the anonymous and forgotten activists, musicians and pioneers who had such an importance for the success of the Carnival over many years. As a way of preserving the history of the festival and to document its conflicting history, they've now published a book, Carnival, A Photographic and Testimonial History of the Notting Hill Carnival. Margaret and Ishmael, and your weighty tome, which is here, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Ishmael, if I can start with you first of all, the book, it's a pretty impressive piece, amazing to leaf through. Just tell us about some of the actual archive photography that's in here. Amazing shots documenting not just social history, but the whole evolution of the event. Tell us a bit about the sort of the background of the archive.
Most of the images came from a chap who's recognised my father, not my biological father, but a chap that kind of grew me up when I was very young. And he had taken images of Carnival from the very first one up until 2010. He was a chap called Alan Capitan Thornhill, who was also a head of security for Michael X, the notorious, well, Michael DeFreitas alias Michael X, the notorious sort of, you know, black power come henchman for Peter Ruckman, who was a slumlord around Notting Hill at the time. And, you know, so Capitan was also around people like Michael X when they came to the UK. He did security for Muhammad Ali, the Henry Cooper fight, Dick Gregory, Nina Simone, Kwame Ture, all of the black key political characters who'd come into Britain. He was the one who was responsible for security. He was a chap who's considered my father, and he had all of these sort of images. He always takes shots, and he died, sadly. He passed away in March and left me all the images. But we were working on this book for about the last 2-3 years with him, in collaboration with him, and he would sort of take us through what was going on at this time, and, you know, which gave it a much more authentic feel, if you like, in terms of understanding what was going on. And all these other photographers who then participated, like Charlie Phillips, Homer Sykes, Norman Reed, Vernon Saint-Hilaire, some great photographers, and just the whole spirit in which we sort of decided to produce the book.
Margaret, I wanted to ask you, what was clear from the introduction is that there's a sense that comes across in this book that many of the people who were involved in the formation of Carnival, and actually it's interesting, it's not quite clear even when Carnival really began, it has some kind of interesting roots. But there are lots of people who have been involved along the way who perhaps haven't got the kind of shout out, as it were, that they deserved. Is this book part of trying to kind of pull in more of the people who did actually play a part in the history of Carnival and kind of give credit where it's due?
Yes, I think that's certainly the case, which is why there's that word in the title, testimonial, because a lot of snippets in the book are actual first-person accounts from people who were there, who saw the early years, who participated in one way or another, whether it's somebody like Wilf Walker, who was involved with getting live bands into the system, or Leslie Palmer, who was crucial in terms of organising the carnival from 1973. So there are lots of first-hand reports from people who were actually there from the beginning, as well as feedback from people who are not actually based in London, like Peter Minchell, who's a great carnival band designer in Trinidad, who's given us some information about that. So there are people like that. We wanted to make sure it was clear that they had a part, and it wasn't just something that, you know, was down to one person necessarily. Although the main person who has been sort of airbrushed out of it, rather, is Ronnie Laslett, who was a social worker in Notting Hill, who started what was really the first outdoor street festival, which we consider is what grew into today's carnival.
Also along the route, obviously this, you know, this carnival it kind of belongs to the Afro-Caribbean community in many senses. It grew out of that. But along the route...
It's unfair to say.
Okay, but along the route, what you document is, you know, a kind of hippie community became involved. There were many kind of white people who were involved in the early days. And maybe that, do you think that some of that history has been kind of lost as well?
Well, when you say it belongs to the African-Caribbean community, you're giving away ownership of it. This carnival came out of the Notting Hill Festival, which was started by Ronnie Laslett, who was half Native American, half Russian. Her husband was Irish. Do you mean the people who also led the first parades were the Dagenham Girl Pipers? So, and Ronnie Laslett, when she started the carnival, it was a result of the race riots of 1958. We had the murder of Kelso Cochrane. At that juncture, people of the community of Notting Hill said enough is enough, and something had to be done. And so, you know, there were all different movements. The Communist Party was marching in along Blenheim Crescent around Notting Hill, saying, you know, we've got to do more to kind of get together. So the festival came out of that atmosphere. Ronnie Laslett said, you know, we all live in the same slum together, so we've all got to learn how to get along. So in the first carnival, there were Irish, Indian, Czechoslovakian, Ukrainian, West Indian, African, and it was about people coming out and celebrating the culture together. Incidentally, the first treasurer of carnival was Pete Jenner, who was the manager of Pink Floyd. Pink Floyd played at the first carnival. These are all those little things that people don't really recognise. So when you say it's owned by no one. People have sort of obviously taken over it and put their hallmark on it, of which then others feel marginalised from that. But certainly if you've been to the carnival over the last 10 years, you'll see that it's been internationally reclaimed. So it doesn't belong to anyone. Who knows? In a few years' time, we'll probably have an Irish brand on it. But let's shift it from year to year. Do you know what I mean? Well, and, you know, who knows?
That's one of the things I wanted to ask you, actually. I wonder whether it's, in a way, the fact that some of the activists and this history that you talk about, where it came out of these race relations problems in the sort of 50s and 60s, is it a measure, in a way, of the success of carnival, that some of the activists maybe aren't as well known, their work in those formative years has been maybe forgotten because it's become so successful at galvanising the community that people almost forget that there were these tensions which were a lot of the drivers, you know, in the early days.
The carnival is a testament of that. The carnival is a testament of what these groundbreaking pioneers were creating at that time. You know, we're not just talking about the race riots, we're talking about poor housing, we're talking about slum conditions, we're talking about no spaces for children to play on the streets. So there was a sense of social action. That's where the hippies came in. And there was a case of sort of marginalisation of the black community. There was a case of sort of police stop and search brutality against the black community. There were all of these sort of things that made that ingredients of sort of marginalisation and you know, disenfranchisement of the community, and people then deciding to sort of come together and working together, sort of create something out of that.
Do you think, Margaret, it's interesting picking up on that point then, the way that West London has changed, particularly this area around Notting Hill, Portobello, you know, it couldn't be more different now than it was 50, 60 years ago. Has the relationship fundamentally then shifted with carnival? Instead of communities of people, there's a lot of private homes, you know, houses that are owned by sort of, you know, millionaires. Do you think that there's now a new, if you like, detachment between carnival and the people who are living there now, Margaret?
Well, certainly when I first lived in Notting Hill, I'm probably the oldest person in the studio, it was in the late 60s, and I lived there because it's the only place I could afford to live. And I was paying me and my then husband, I was a child bride, of course, and we were paying 7 guineas a week. And that's the reason we were living there, because it was a poor area that we could afford. So it's certainly, you cannot see it that way now. And I think it's good for the people who live there now to see what it has come from and what carnival maybe has contributed, rather than seeing it as some sort of, I mean, it's a bit like that film Notting Hill, which kind of ignored the fact that there were black people in Notting Hill.
I worked on Notting Hill. I did a casting when they were making Notting Hill. Richard Curtis and Duncan Kenworthy came to see me to ask permission. Not ask permission. Who am I? King of Notting Hill? No. They came and asked, listen, we'd like to film on the streets. How would it be possible? And I was responsible for the casting. Did that with 2020 and selected about 700 characters. I think it was Sue Quinn was the sort of production manager at the time. And with that, they said they wanted something which was reflective of the community. And we did the casting and made sure that the real flavour and characters were going to be in there. People like Sledge, people obviously you won't know him by name, but this iconic Rasta man with silver locks that flowed down his back. And they selected these characters, and then they created false scenes to filming to make it look as though the community were participating. And then in the edit, when it came out, everyone was so stunned and shocked. And then I read an interview later on with Sue Quinn where she said, oh, we were very cunning in the way we went about filming the streets. So they'd rather hired hundreds of extras just so that the community doesn't sort of disrupt the filming when they knew what they were doing. I felt that was a bit underhanded at the time.
Could you tell us what you think today the role of carnival is? In the US, we've seen tragic events in Ferguson. We've seen cases here in London as well over the past few years, which have highlighted the fact that, you know, the racial issues still exist, you know, not just between, you know, the black community and the supposedly white community, but between all sorts of people coming to the city. Is Carnival still one of those moments where for a weekend people see what it's like to kind of, you know, lift all those barriers and actually people kind of be on the street and kind of drinking and eating and just getting on?
I mean, look at the spectacle of Carnival. It falls nearing sort of ending of summer, children going back to school. It's a celebration for the entire country if it is embraced and endorsed correctly by the state. I still think that, you know, people, you know, as we opened up saying it's owned by the Caribbean community, that's diverse, you know, that's how we came into this. That's divisive. If we look at it for what it is, as one of the greatest spectacles of costume, music, song, dance, and street theatre, a really unique sense of street theatre, then it's something that should be celebrated. I don't think people really sort of respect and acknowledge the sort of artistry that goes into creating such magic for 2 days. 363 days of the year, people are weaving this spell to kind of deliver this spectacle for 2 days. And these are artists. They're not making papier-mâché costumes and masks. These are costume makers. These are artists, yet they're not recognized in that way. The steel pan makers, they're not even seen as musicians. Yet some of them are classically trained. Some of them rehearse 3-6 months of the year, 7 months of the year to deliver their magic for 2 days. And I think that, you know, there's something wrong in the way that the artists and the people who perform it and make it have not been acknowledged. And so when we talk about, you know, what it presents for this country, it presents a spectacle of glamour, of costume, of artistry, of culture, of music, of, you know, I mean, of all of these great elements that makes up Britain. And as long as we keep saying, oh, it's black, it's white, it's this or it's that, you know, I mean, we lose what it's about. It was Ronnie Lazarus' vision. We all live in the same slum together. Let's come out and celebrate our culture. You know what I mean?
Well, I think if you want people to look afresh at Carnival, one of the ways they can do that, to bring us back to where we began, is to look at this amazing book, Carnival, A Photographic and Testimonial History of the Notting Hill Carnival. Ishmael and Margaret, thanks both for coming to see us on this most busy of weekends, of course, for you, to tell us all about it. Thanks for coming.
Are you going to be at the Carnival?
Thank you.
Of course.
Oh, no. Well, we'll be by Gazza's Rock and Blues. Come and check us out down there.
See you there.
And that pretty much brings the curtain down on this 268th edition of the Monocle Weekly. Andrew, I'm feeling in kind of a carnival frame of mind now, understandably, one might say.
Well, I saw your float was outside. Are you going to jump aboard?
I travel in style. Well, I'm keeping my powder dry for tomorrow. That's the big day, of course. But I might just, you know, swing by this afternoon, maybe get some bit of chicken, bit of rice and peas.
Is it Children's Day today? Or was that yesterday?
I can't remember. It's just you're gradually limbering up for the real excesses of tomorrow.
Good. Well, I'll join you on your float and bang your drum too. Thank you very much, Tom Edwards. Shall we say goodbye to people?
Let's do it.
Before we get into any trouble.
Well, indeed. Let's thank various people. Our producer, Marco Sippi, and our studio manager, Clara Barn, and Bill Luty. We'll be here again, won't we, next week, Andrew? It may not be me, it may not be you, but somebody will be here. Perhaps Rob Bound will be back in the chair.
I've got a feeling I won't know even it is me if I am here. Anyway, from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye. Thanks for tuning in.